Hello, and welcome to Studio Sessions, the big red and shiny podcast where we talk with artists about the ideas, inspiration, and processes that go into their work. I'm your host, Matt Kuhlman, and my guest this episode is Musa Hickson. Musa earned his BFA at Hampton University in Virginia in 1995 and received an MFA in sculpture from the Pratt Institute in 1998. Many of Musa's pieces rely on the use of circles or spheres to create his forms. A long-running convention in his work is creating dream catchers out of different materials and using them in various settings. Also present in his works are references to artifacts and ideas found in several other primitive cultures. Join me as he explains the sources and meaning of the symbolic devices he's using. So how are you doing today?
Doing good, thank you, man.
Good to meet you here in your studio up in... Which neighborhood are we in? Are we still in Bed-Stuy here?
Well, this is technically Clinton Hill.
Okay.
The Navy Yard is one block from here, so people also call this the Brooklyn Navy Yard area.
Mm-hmm. And I was interested because you said you were from this neighborhood.
Yes.
And it's somewhat rare to like meet artists who actually grew up in New York. Most people move here from somewhere else and...
Yeah.
Establish themselves. So what was your experience like growing up in this area as an artist?
Well, I moved here at 5 years old to establish myself as an artist. No, but actually I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, but my mother and myself moved to Brooklyn when I was about 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And moved around a bit, lived in different towns, Texas and back in Cleveland, Virginia. But most of my life, I lived in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And this neighborhood is Clinton Hill. I went to elementary school, junior high school, Pratt,
yeah.
graduate school.
Yeah, right Pratt's here. Just right here, too. So.
Absolutely. It's always been a very arts-rich neighborhood. Tons of artists have their studios in this neighborhood. But it's not, like you said, it's not many of the artists that are actually from this neighborhood. But mm-hmm. it does attract a lot of artists and creative people.
What kind of work were you seeing at the time that you were growing up around here? How aware were you of the arts from what age? Or?
Well, I always knew that Pratt was a art, engineering, and architecture school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the street I grew up on is Clinton and Myrtle, and Pratt is about two blocks away from that. So just knowing that the students were going there were like studying architecture, studying art, so on and so forth. Also Spike Lee is from this neighborhood, and as a kid,
okay.
That was my introduction to what independent film was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like people started talking, there's a guy in our neighborhood that makes movies. You know, that's the guy. You know, I'd see him walking through the neighborhood and how did he make these films? Well, he raised the money himself, you know, and it was like, you know.
So you kind of saw the opportunities presenting themselves that you could do this if you wanted to.
Well, there was an example of someone in the neighborhood within him. I started seeing you know, a lot of student artists that were starting to stay in the neighborhood, not move out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, by the time I got to junior high school, I can see that there was a kind of a cultural vibe, a cultural community that probably already existed, but mm-hmm. I found myself growing into it myself, you know,
mm-hmm.
and the way I approached things and, you know, creativity and where I wanted to hang out and who I thought was cool,
mm-hmm.
you know.
So you had a commitment to art, to making art pretty early in your life?
I would say fairly early. It probably wasn't until high school that I really saw that this was something that I was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, initially, like a lot of artists, to be honest, I think it was kind of like a self-therapy, you
yeah.
know, because I was kind of a strange kid, maybe like a lot of creative people are. And in art class, I found that the process was calming to me, and that was something I just really wanted to do. And when I thought about what to major in, when I knew that I was going to college... art became my first choice, because anything else, I think I would have dropped out of school because I just didn't care about doing
That kind of describes me too in high school.
Oh, okay.
I skip all the other classes and go to art class.
Yeah, yeah. I would stay, you know, after school during lunchtime, you know, finishing projects. I got all A's in art. And, you know, I was like, you know, just why fight it? You know, this is what I want to do.
You know? Were there any artists that you were inspired by or looking to emulate starting out? Because right now you work very abstractly for a lot of things, it seems like.
Yes.
And very large kind of public sculptures too.
Yes.
So is that what you were starting out wanting to do, or did you kind of grow to that from a different spot?
Well, I would say my early influences were graffiti art, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there was a public art influence that just came from growing up in Brooklyn. And, you know, as a kid, hip-hop culture was very predominant, very influential in this urban setting. And all of my friends were breakdancing, trying to be a rapper, mm-hmm. wanting to be a DJ, and doing graffiti. And that was the culture of it. You know, how you dressed, you know, what you did with your friends. And, you know, I aspired to be as good an artist as my best friend Curtis. You know, he draw very well, and he was a graffiti artist and an aspiring graffiti artist.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up going to FIT, that's Fashion Institute. Technology, and you know, I wanted to be good at graffiti. You know,
did you
go
out and do a lot of graffiti as a younger kid?
Well, you know, I guess I did what we call tagging. You know, tagging is just like when you have like one little name.
Uh-huh.
You know, and mine was Curtis was C E was C, which was C E E, and I put and my name. My born name is Carl, so I would put C-E-E-2. That wasn't too creative, but, you know.
Other people know you were there.
Yeah, you know. So I did some tagging and stuff. I was never as good as a lot of graffiti arts people that I know. They call themselves writers, graph writers, that I know. I still have a lot of friends that are into it. And, you know, gradually I started being attracted more to three-dimensional art.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know if that answered your question.
Oh yeah. What kind of a transition, what was the process of moving from graffiti into more three-dimensional, like what kind of things did you start making that bridged that gap?
Well, when I went to college, initially I was a painting major, because the background of drawing and being interested in graph art you know, led me to painting, led me to wanting to do public painting, working on canvases, so on and so forth. When I got to college, I had a sculpture and ceramics professor named Mpofuante.
Mm-hmm.
Mpofuante is a Ghanaian sculptor at Hampton University in Virginia, where I went to undergraduate school. And he became like a mentor towards me. And I became so interested in his process with the materials that he worked with that I just veered towards three-dimensional work. You know, I've also always been very interested in history. I'm a big history buff. I recently taught college art history for about 10 years.
Okay.
And his work being based in a lot of African traditional art forms mixed with modern art became a foundational influence for me, and it kind of carries through a lot of work that I do even now. You know,
what kind of things was he making? I'm not familiar with.
Well, he's primarily a ceramic artist. I think a lot of his, and he's from Ghana, it seems like a lot of his forms seem to be based in maybe Akan or some of the local cultures of West Africa. I see him working with clay, of course, working with wood.
Some are kind of like the folk objects that they would make, or
yes,
drawing from them.
Drawing from that, but a modernist approach also. using ropes and things like that to wrap his ceramic artwork, you know, became very interesting to me. You know, over time, I started looking at Aboriginal artwork. I started looking at Native American artwork, Chinese, Japanese artwork. But all of those things being the very ancient or very indigenous forms. Mm-hmm. When I went to graduate school at Pratt, all of my teachers were either modernist, abstract, conceptual, or minimalist. Mm-hmm. You know, so
kind of like the common stuff you find in art school.
Yeah, so that's pretty standard. You know, the mm-hmm. the people who would be the age that would be my teacher, they're all minimalist, they're all conceptual. You know, so that blend kind of came together naturally because of, I guess, my teachers and where mm-hmm. I was at the time, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, as far as the things that you were looking at in other cultures, you seem to have been really drawn to the Dreamcatcher.
Yes.
I've seen several pieces of yours that use that. Do you want to explain your interest in that form and your use of it?
Yeah. A lot of Dreamcatchers in my work. I've always been interested in making circles. Circles, mm-hmm. spheres, balls, things round.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Since my days at graduate school, a lot of my research in the circle, as it relates to indigenous cultures, there's a meaning of it that relates to often, you know, the sun or a symbol of some type of omnipotence, a symbol of the universe and its place. Stars, so on and so forth. You know, everything
and
that
specifically in like the Lakota culture, I know they like they're the ones that had the teepees. They live in the roundhouse, and that was drawn off of that idea and also the practicality of it.
Yeah,
and they would arrange their teepees in a circle. So.
Yeah. I mean, I have some drawings even on the wall. You know, this one right here. You know, but this is not specifically Lakota. But it's in general of some of the Native American circular forms that I research.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the type of configuration that would represent sun and stars. Mm-hmm. But when you talk about the center of the village and the teepees placed around that, or like a dot with a circle around it representing the bullseye or alertness or awareness or shining light on something,
mm-hmm.
you know, bringing attention to something. So I've been making circles like forever. About 3 years ago, I had a show coming up, and I started thinking about also how dreams influence my work. Like I might have just a shape coming to mind, an abstract shape comes to mind in a dream, and I'll go to the studio and want to make that shape, you know. And dream catchers being in a circular pattern, you know, and I just said, you know, I want to take these dream catcher type configurations and this weaving pattern and see if I can weave this into various types of shapes, you know, so over the past 3 years, you know, it's been a strong influence. You know?
Mm. What are some of the different ways that they've been displayed or used, I suppose, because
mm-hmm.
their positioning depends on, like, their function, as far as I understand it. So.
Yeah. I mean, one example, a couple examples, as it relates to my public work, 2 years ago, I was working on a residency in public art project in Obama, Japan. Spelled the same way.
Yeah.
But it's a small fishing village in Japan. And I was brought out there to work for 6 weeks along with another artist named Gregory Coates. And they wanted some kind of public artwork. And I presented to them an idea where I had three 10-foot tall dream catchers connected in a spiral type manner.
Mm-hmm.
And being that they're a fishing village, instead of the normal weaving pattern that I might use, I took some of the local fishing nets
mm-hmm.
and I actually connected that to the three Dreamcatcher shapes. And I called that piece Dreams United, kind of like, you know, kind of connections of different cultures and you know, their aspirations and dreams. And it was really good. You know, it was set in front of a school there. And the actual principal of that school was also a songwriter. He wrote a song about it. And yeah. The kids sang the song. It's on YouTube. But it was a couple people cried. It was interesting. Now, something else I've done as far as public work with the Dreamcatcher pattern, the next year, 2011, I was invited by a project called 3D Foundation to be part of their high altitude sculpture park in Verbier, Switzerland. Okay. And in that project, I made two what I call vision pods. These vision pods I've made a few times where I take most of the time soil and make a particular type of shape, you know, usually something close to a sphere or a pod type shape, and I use rope I use rope and weave a dream catcher type of pattern around those pods.
Okay.
And with that one, I also connected about 110, I think, metal spheres around that. And
so at the center you had the pod, and then coming off of that there were the spheres around it. Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you see this pod sitting, it kind of looks like a pod sitting over here.
Mm-hmm.
Something like this.
Okay.
But 8 feet tall.
Yeah. It's like a large dome with a green catcher over it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Those are a couple examples. You know, there's a dream catcher above you right there. And like I said, for the past 3 years, in my gallery work and in my public work, that weaving pattern comes back. You know, not always an exact circular shape, but a connection between what is made and kind of the process of how those ideas come to me, and often they are in dreams or daydreams or, you know, that continuous connection with my love for history and how those indigenous art forms and shapes push their ways through, you know, our contemporary art forms.
What are some specific pieces that you've drawn out of dreams?
You know, most of all of this stuff comes
pretty
out of
dreams.
Pretty
much all of it.
To be honest, most all of this stuff comes out of dreams. I can tell you a little bit about my process. To this wall to the right of you, you see some brown paper rolled up against the wall. All of this paper comes from my house. I put paper on the wall in case I get an idea, in case through meditation, daydreaming, dreaming, just sitting around thinking, a shape comes to mind, or a connection through some particular idea and how that can be expressed through a shape, you know, and I sketch that out, you know. Sometimes it might be a wall piece, it may be an installation or a sculpture.
I see when it looks like you have an idea of putting some of those pod forms on the ceiling.
Yeah, exactly. So that comes to mind, you know, for example, a pod form or a ceiling, or, you know, I may have something over here where there's a metallic person sitting in the woods, you know, or, you know, a reoccurring shape that I have here with this dot and this line, which I call witness shapes, which are representatives of a particular spirit or an entity in a space.
Okay.
As those ideas come, I sketch them down, I sketch them out. If I think it can be developed a little bit further, I may go into a more detailed drawing. And if that's working out, then eventually it may turn into, you know, a painting or a sculpture, something like that, or one of the pieces that you might see over there. You know, so they're all, to a certain degree, coming from a dream or a daydream, you know. To me, that is the most honest the more honest process. Often when I try to just think my way into a idea that I think is a good idea for artwork, I feel that it becomes dishonest because I'm trying to maybe please a certain market or please a certain person or idea or something. So, you know, the kind of things that come up in meditation or sleep, I feel are the most honest.
Yeah, I remember seeing some pieces with that Whitman shape, as you called it. Do you want to describe what those objects were that you were making and what they're about? Because to me, they kind of look like flags in a way, particularly having several kind of stripes and being an American. That's the first thing you think when you see a rectangle like that is stripes on the flag. But
You know, well, it's two things. First of all, as far as the flags, on my website, there's a section under galleries that says flags.
Okay.
It has some of my flags. I've actually been making flags before I even made Dreamcatchers or The Witnesses or something, even back to the 1990s, late 1990s. My Stars and Bars series, where I may have a mirror with metal bars over that, so that when you look at the mirror, you can kind of see yourself behind these bars in this flag type of shape. I've been interested in using the flag in different kind of configurations as it relates to me as an African American or people of various cultures in a country of various cultures in their relationship to the flag or the relationship to the meaning of being an American. You know, of course, you know, America has a creed and a representation of its kind of democracy and liberty, you know, but to various people, that's not necessarily the situation, or they could have had a history of just the opposite, you know, just as my history as African American can be just the opposite. Now, separately from that, my witness type shapes, there's a shape where there's a dot or a circle with a line below that, which kind of looks like a head with a skinny body. You know, I call these witnesses because I see these as entities or figures that are witnessing what is occurring or what is here the whole time. You know, so I put them in flags. I put them in different type configurations. I put them in circles, you know, kind of saying, you know, I'm here observing the truth, or I'm here the whole time, or I know the real story. So,
and when you make these flags, is this something that you would just kind of place out in public for people to see, or would it, do you keep it more of a gallery setting?
Well, in general, any of the work would be placed according to, I guess, where it would be appropriate, you know.
So you said you made one with the mirror. You can't just put that out in public. Somebody might break it. But
yeah, I mean, if it's not... Yeah.
If you got a fabric flag, you could just hang it somewhere and somebody might see it and wonder what it is.
I mean, like, sometimes I make things out of soil, you know, and according to how that is configured, you know, it may be weather resistant enough to withstand outside, you know, as opposed to, like you said, something made out of, you know, something made out of glass or something made out of plastic that, you know, if it's rained on or bumped or something, might be broken. So, you know, it's really, whether it's going to be outside public work or gallery, you know, is really according to how appropriate it is for the environment. Simple as that.
And you were talking about kind of the makeup of American stuff, and right here you have a piece of the United States of America with the chain. It's very different from your other pieces, so I'd like to know more about your idea of making it.
Yeah, that's a little bit older piece.
Okay.
You know, it's a piece that I call Stars and Bars. I made that around 2003. It's a made out of aluminum, and it has a steel chain over it with a master lock holding that steel chain over the shape of the United States. Did I say Stars and Bars or Homeland Security?
Stars and Bars.
Oh, no, sorry. Stars and Bars is the Flag series. This okay. is Homeland Security.
Okay.
So let me correct that. Homeland Security, the shape of the America, a shape of America made out of aluminum with a steel chain and a master lock around it, mm-hmm. made in 2003. The reason for that was there was this Homeland Security initiative that was promoted not too far after 9/11.
Yeah, you probably heard about it about every 10 seconds.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it was to protect us from terrorism. Mm-hmm. But even at that time, you know, we were starting to see that it was actually starting to restrict the civil rights of Americans. You know, mm-hmm. so the question becomes, is this to protect us or is it to control us? Mm-hmm. You know, during that time, my work was a little bit more directly political. You know, my time of making those Stars and Bars flags, my time of making this Homeland Security piece.
Yeah, it's very direct.
Yeah, it has direct political connotations. Since then, there is still somewhat social elements in my work, but, you know, I'm kind of mixing it with I would say an abstract or sometimes even spiritual element that allows you the freedom to find, you know, what you think the social element is, as opposed to the more confrontational stuff that I was interested in at a younger age.
Yeah. And we've kind of covered several of the influences from other cultures that you're drawing from. Are there any other cultural influences that you use in your pieces that we haven't talked about yet?
Well, you know, it's really everything. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really everything. You know, it's right now is an interesting time for me because, you know, I an artist process. I find it similar to a scientist experimenting with different things to kind of resolve a certain issue or come up with a certain elixir or something like that, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, as I stated, I'm deeply interested in every culture, you know, especially indigenous cultures, mm-hmm. you know, things that might be considered primitive or prehistoric or things like that. Mm-hmm.
You had mentioned, like, Aboriginal art or something. Do you use, like, imagery from any of that in your pieces that we haven't talked about yet?
Well,
drawn specifically, because the Dreamcatcher is a very specific, like, draw from Native American culture.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I was wondering if there are other such direct things that you're drawing off of.
Well, something that has been, that has come up a lot that has influenced me from Aboriginal artwork is these consistent dot patterns. Consistent dot patterns in circles, mm-hmm. you know. So I've already been interested in circles, already been interested in dots. Mm-hmm. But in traditional Aboriginal artwork, the use of these dots in circles to make larger patterns, to make whole pieces of artwork, has been very interesting to me. And what it means from a cosmic state, you know, kind of this recreation of kind of cosmic shapes, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And right now, in my work, I'm very interested in seeing how I can find the universality of this. I guess what's common amongst various cultures. You know, if I'm looking at indigenous African art forms, or Native American, or Aboriginal, or East Asian, you know, or European. Where do these shapes keep coming up again and again?
You see these kind of circular shapes through all of them?
Yeah, I'm seeing different shapes coming up again and again. Like those shapes at the bottom of this drawing here, they're from all different cultures. You know, it may seem like they're from one, but the ones at the bottom are West African, the ones to the right are Native American, the ones to the left and the top, these are all Aboriginal, you know. But kind of seeing where these shapes reoccur, and where they mean the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, if on the other side of the world, if they're making the same shape, then it means the same thing. And then, you know, somewhere else, they're making the same shape, and it means the same thing. You know, it's very interesting to me, you know, is there a type of universal language that over time I can somehow utilize? I don't know, it's just very interesting to me. Mm-hmm. I find the process very interesting.
Saw a note that I made here that you used barbed wire in a lot of pieces. I forgot about that. Some pretty. At what point were you making those pieces?
You know, I still work with a lot of barbed wire. You know, I've made dream catchers out of barbed wire. I've made whole figures, whole human beings out of barbed wire. Mm-hmm. You know, I had an installation at 5 Miles Gallery here in Brooklyn last year where I made a figure out of barbed wire that was connected to an umbilical cord, and the umbilical cord was connected to the ceiling and kind of went around the room. Mm. And I had the room also filled with weather balloons, 8-foot weather balloons.
Did they pop?
No, but it was the tension that okay. I was going for. Like, you know, when you go in a room that's full of balloons and barbed wire, you're like, oh, something's going to happen
don't
here.
Don't shake it up too
yeah. bad. You know, so... in that installation, I was very much interested in the tension that may be created with a room full of barbed wire and balloons, mm-hmm. you know. But in general, barbed wire is a difficult material to work with. Mm-hmm. And to take something that is difficult, that is somewhat dangerous, and make it more fluent, to make shapes out of it, to make flowing shapes out of it, to make... shapes that would be of, you know, living figures, you know, shapes that would be, you know, plants or flowers or something like that. Just became, mm-hmm. you know, kind of an interesting process. You know? Yeah. So that's how I kind of got into it.
Yeah, it's also kind of a purely American symbol by how that's how we kind of were able to expand out west so quickly. It was barbed wire made it possible to fence things off really quickly. So
yeah, yeah.
I find that kind of connection interesting in it too.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that contrast of, I mean, in your mind, when you look at barbed wire, it means, you know, this is mine, this is my territory, and you're going to get hurt or something if you yeah. come over here. You
don't
know.
Mess with it, don't cross that
Yeah,
line.
Don't come over here, you know. You know, and me using that to make living figures or to make, a dream catcher or a flower, or you know, I've even used it to make hearts or organs or something like that, is you know, in that sense I became interested in creating that tension of taking that saying keep away and doing something opposite of it, so hopefully when the viewer's looking at it, it kind of changes their mind about materials and, you know, what something could mean, mm-hmm. you know, or just creating a tension between what you believe it should mean and what your eye is showing you that mm-hmm. it's doing.
And have we covered your most recent work yet in the Dreamcatchers, or is there upcoming projects that we haven't touched on yet?
Well, the Dreamcatcher pattern is in most of all my recent work, mm-hmm. you know,
because you mentioned like the installation you did in Japan was a couple of years ago. I didn't
yeah.
know if there was pieces that were more recent that we hadn't yeah. specifically discussed.
Yeah, that the work in Japan, and then the year after that, the work in Switzerland in the high altitude sculpture park. I recently did an installation in Havana. At the Havana Biennial this past May.
Havana, Cuba?
Yeah, Havana, okay. Cuba.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it was actually a the Center for Experimental Art is the name of the gallery in Havana where I showed, I initially had a solo show But I turned it into a group show and arranged to have some other artists here from Brooklyn. We called the show Soyondo en Color. So myself and a few other artists, Gregory Coates, Danny Simmons, Marilyn Nance, Derek Adams, all showed there. And within that show, and some of that is on my website, but within that show, my particular installation, I showed a room filled with my witnesses. So in that exhibit, painted on the wall, room full of the witnesses, and they were connected by fishing wire, the invisible kind of fishing wire. Okay. And this is something I've done a few times with my room installations, where I grid rooms with fishing wire, you know, so that the viewer at a certain point realizes they can't actually move around in that room. Yeah. So these figures are connected, but they're connected through this kind of invisible, ethereal kind of way. And for the viewer, they have to kind of deal with a space that's kind of cut off from them, mm-hmm. that they don't realize until they get kind of right up on it. You know, so a room that you have to kind of like look in without walking in fully. Mm-hmm. And that's some of my more recent work. You know, I'm preparing for a show that's going to be at the Elizabeth Foundation this upcoming 2003. And so a lot of the work that you may see in my studio that has dream catchers with within bicycle wheels, you know, and my witness shapes with the Aboriginal dot patterns will most likely be in that exhibition.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, anything else you wanted to follow up with or touch back on before we go?
I think we covered everything in the world.
Sounds good. Just about all the questions. Everybody's denied.
Everything that was on my mind at this point. I appreciate it.
Yeah, sounds good. Thanks for meeting with me.
Yeah, thank you, Matt.
Yeah.
And that concludes this episode of Studio Sessions with our guest Musa Hickson. You can find his work online at musaartonline.com. You can also learn more about me at my website, mattkuhlman.com. If you'd like to support this program, you can send a donation through PayPal to studiosessionspodcast@gmail.com. Even if you only send $1, your donation helps guarantee I can continue providing interviews with interesting artists for your listening pleasure. And of course, don't forget to visit bigredandshiny.com for future episodes, along with other arts and culture content. Thank you for listening, and see you next time on Studio Sessions.